Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Board Game Bros.
I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
And this is the Board Game Bros, where we discuss board games, board game hobby, board game design, everything board games.
Everything board games. Of course, we are brothers in real life and board game designers in real life.
Yes, never forget that fact.
That is us.
All right.
So, I hope you enjoyed our newest episode of Board Game Bros Good Stuff,
where we talked about some things that weren't board games.
Like video games.
But now we're back to the actual board games.
Yep.
The board games.
The board
games. And today we certainly have a game that uses a board.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say the board is probably one of the most important parts about this game.
Probably.
And that game, of course, is a game called Small World.
Yep.
So, Matthew, give me a little history about Small World.
Yeah, Small World was designed by Philippe Cayarts. I'm sorry, I might have butchered that pronunciation.
Sorry, Philippe, we know you're listening. We really don't mean anything by it. You got a cool name, and we're just not cool enough to know how to pronounce it.
It was published in 2009 by Days of Wonder. It was nominated for many awards, and also won a number of awards, including the 2009 Meeple's Choice Award and the 2010 Games Magazine Game of the Year Award.
All right. And when was it published again?
Published in 2009.
Okay.
Now, an interesting fact is that this is based off the designer's 1999 release game called Vinci, which was modeled as like a diceless variant of Risk.
Mm-hmm.
It had many similar mechanics, though it had a historic theme instead of what Small World has, which is a very fantasy theme.
Mm-hmm. And the way that I would describe Small World is much like fantasy Risk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Risk, you use dice a lot to determine whether or not you've conquered a territory from an opponent. In Small World, there's no dice really involved in conquering territories. Only very minimal use of dice in this game. Usually, whether or not you conquer a territory is only determined by whether or not you have enough pieces to conquer it. So there's no variance there. You just, if you have enough pieces, the territory is yours.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike Risk. To delve a little bit more into what Small World is all about, to describe the game, it's like Fantasy Risk. Players attempt to conquer an unclaimed territory with randomly generated fantasy armies, such as diplomatic skeletons, bivouacking giants, flying sorcerers, and many others. The game lasts for 9 rounds, and each round players take turns either conquering the land with an army or putting their army in decline so they can start fresh with a new army next turn. You score points for each territory your active and in decline troops occupy at the end of your turn, and the player with the most points at the end of the game wins. That's the basics of Small World. So I mentioned at the beginning of that description that there's random armies. This is a unique thing in this game that makes it really fun for the fantasy geek in me.
Adds a lot of replay value.
Yeah, so let's talk about the strategy of Small World goes into playing it.
Yeah.
And I want to start with the armies.
Mm-hmm.
So in the game, there are 14 races and 20 special powers. And at the beginning of the game, you shuffle the races all together in one pile, and you shuffle the powers all together in one pile. And as you play, you are drawing the top card of each one and matching them together to make a combined race. So, like, bivouacking is a special power, and giants is a race. So when you draw those two and put them together, you get bivouacking giants, and that determines what the army size is and what you do with the army.
Mm-hmm. And the army size, in particular, is a combination of a size determined by the power and the race.
Mm-hmm. So one way that this game balances the races and powers is it gives them a different number of troops to start with. And in the game, they have these small square cardboard chits that you use to be your army.
That's your units,
Those are your units, yeah. So the combined total of your races number and your special powers number is how many of those you get. Some special powers, the most you get from a special power is 5, in addition to your race, which can be anywhere from 3 to 8. You can have anywhere in between, what's
8
the lowest?
And 13.
5.
Oh, no, yeah.
5 and 13.
Wow, yeah.
So part of the strategy in this game is when you start the game, there's only 5 of these, you can see in a row. and you have to select them and then start expanding from the side of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you know what the different races and special powers do in combination with each other, as well as opposed to the other available races and powers, then right off the bat, you'll have a leg up on somebody else that's a newer player to the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because the point of the game is to expand to as much territory as you can and take advantage of that territory. For example, like a human gets bonus points for conquering a farmland.
Mm-hmm.
So you would want to expand to more farmlands mm-hmm. with a human. And a hill special power gives you bonus points for conquering the hill regions.
Mm-hmm.
So you would want to go to, if you are a hill human, then you're going to want to start where in a place where there's a lot of hills and a lot of farms.
Mm-hmm.
Or
like giants can conquer territories next to mountains that they control at one unit less.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really good at riding down the mountains and attacking from there.
So when you can, at a glance, understand that, okay, I can see that there's a part of the board that's open, like nobody else has settled there yet, and it's got a lot of hills and a lot of farms, and you see hill humans are right there, you can go ahead and take hill humans and you can start get a lot of mm-hmm. points.
Now, of course, if there is a race power combination that you really want, you can't always just pick it up and use it, because
you stack them up
in order that they are drawn.
Right, you stack up five at the beginning. The one at the bottom of the stack, you can just take that.
For free, yeah.
For free. But for every race above that, you need to put a gold coin on the first on the races before it.
Mm-hmm.
So and if you course, want the second one, you got to put your coin on the first
and
one.
And of course, gold coins are literally points.
Yeah.
And when you take a race power combination that has coins already on it, you get those coins.
So like less desirable races and powers at the beginning of the game will collect a lot of coins so that towards the end of the game, they will be more desirable because they're going to be worth an immediate amount of points for that
right.
turn.
And the more desirable races cost more coins in theory because you'll have to more than likely spend at least one coin to get it.
Yeah, because the least desirable races won't move.
Yeah.
So they'll pile up at the bottom of the stack.
But what I'm saying is you'll have to usually put more of an investment in the powerful races and powers.
Right. So there's one thing I mentioned in the description of the game that is also critical to the strategy involved.
Yes.
And that is this theory called in decline, this concept of in decline.
Mm-hmm.
So in Risk or in many other army games, you pick an army and that's your army for the whole game. And you're out of the game once either your army dies or you've defeated every other army and you've won.
Mm-hmm.
In this game, you are constantly cycling through armies. By acquiring an army, which you do at the beginning of the game, and then putting it in decline, which means you no longer conquer more territories with it, but you keep the pieces on the board flipped upside down.
Yeah.
And then your next turn, you get a new army to start conquering with. So the importance about going in decline is as you are playing a race, you conquer territories, you spread yourself real thin. Mm-hmm. If opponents conquer your territories, you lose one of the pieces from that space. So if you only had one there, it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a stack of them, you keep all but one. But eventually, it's going to be nearly impossible for you to continue to expand and get more points. And after that, it's going to be less and less points every turn because you're going to be slowly whittled away. So there's a point where you just need to abandon a race and pick up a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you should go in decline.
Right. It sort of leads the game to be this loop of battles of attrition.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're slowly getting whittled away at and whittling away the opponents. And then you spread yourself really thin in one last effort and flip all your pieces over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I found going in decline, yeah, and that's usually the strategy, since we're talking mm-hmm. about strategy, that I find is that it's usually you go in decline as soon as you're spread as wide and thin as you possibly can spread yourself.
Yeah.
There's times when, you know, on my next turn, I could conquer one, maybe two more territories,
mm-hmm.
but it's really best just to cut my losses,
yeah.
go in decline then, so that the next time it comes around, I pick a new army, I start expanding, and you get gold for both the territories that your active army occupy and your in decline army occupy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like, you know, you're making an investment for the future that are just continue to pay off as long as nobody conquers the territories that your in decline tokens.
Right. Hold. That's the other thing, is if you go in decline with a race that has like five territories, and soon enough your opponents capture three of those, it's sometimes worth it to just go in decline with the next one soon, because you're not making enough money on your current in decline race.
Right. And you can only have one in decline race at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have, you know, those last two remaining in decline tokens on the board and your current race is starting to get spread a little thin, then you might want to just put your current race in decline and sweep those two away. Because now you've got these new, like, five or six spaces, you know, and I kind of felt, as we were playing the other day, I kind of found that the rule of thumb for in decline is do it sooner rather than later and keep it around as long as you have three or more pieces left.
Yeah.
I found that three, especially because our dad was playing with us and he had, his first race was in decline almost the whole game.
Yeah.
And he expanded once, went and declined the next turn, and he kept three tokens for the whole game, and nobody took them.
Yeah.
And he ended up winning by a huge margin. He protected
those tokens, too.
He protected them, yeah.
He basically just got, like, a race in power for his second set of race in powers that was, like, the ultimate hybrid offense and defense.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because he had diplomatic, which means if you didn't attack... as long as you didn't attack a player on your next turn, you can choose that player to not attack you. You get to choose one player at the end of your turn. And as long as you didn't attack their active race, then they cannot attack your active race on your next turn. And
you
turn.
Can still take out their in decline race.
Yes. But he also had the Amazons, which get extra units for attacking. But they take them away while you're redeploying and defending yourself and shoring up your defenses. So, yeah, he had a really good way to clear out the area around his in-decline races, because this is an area control game where you start from one place and you spread outwards. So he was able to protect the area, the way in to those guys, and then choose somebody who is close and tell them no.
Yeah.
He had a good strategy going into it. And again, I just mentioned this is an area control game. So it's important to be able to look at the map and be able to assess, you know, where your way into the board is, where you're going to be getting the most points, where's the safest place from your opponents,
and where's your opponent's weakest places that you can take.
Yeah, and so you want to go and take those places and then control them by putting up your defenses or knowing where to expand next after you maybe get pushed out. And one thing that I thought was really cool with this game is that because you have this in decline and active race combination, there's even more thought that goes into your expansion.
Yeah.
Because you want to think when you're expanding with one race, when it goes in decline, what your next race is. And you don't want both of these races to be in the same place because you can conquer your own in decline tokens. But you want to avoid that, obviously. Yeah. So you want to make sure that you're not... So, for example, if you're going for those hill humans who want that farmland hill area, which is on a four-player map, there is a very specific area where there's a lot of those clustered together. You want to make sure that your race before those hill humans is nowhere near there.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's near there, it's in the places where you're not going to go so that you can maybe protect it after you expand there with your humans.
Mm-hmm.
I found that with defending, there's a lot of, like, sort of fundamental wargaming strategy that you can keep in mind that will help you with this game. There was a point where I was expanding on a side of the board where you had pieces, Matthew, and I wanted to make sure that when I was taking over the territories that you occupied, I didn't leave any behind on one side of my army. There's sort of a lake in the middle of the board.
Mm-hmm.
So I started on one side of the board and I expanded to the lake and then I took out your area. And so your armies were only on the bottom side and there wasn't any space on the top side. Because on your turn, when you get to start expanding again, if you had both of those territories still available to you, then you could attack me from either side and I would have to split my defenses. So because I was able to just keep it fighting on one front, then I was able to concentrate my defenses to make it very difficult for you to take over my pieces. And the same goes for, you know, like if another person's pieces had been over there, I would want to be very conscious of that and approach things from the safest angle so that when it comes to my opponent's turns, it's harder for them to defeat me.
So I want to bring up something that's sort of a hybrid of game design and strategy in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I found that the game has sort of like a gameplay dichotomy, I guess, of aggression versus expansion. So since it takes two pieces just to take a territory that's empty, and it takes more to take a territory that has things in it already, you have to really carefully weigh whether or not attacking your opponents is worth it. Because if you're spending four spaces on your opponent's space that has two units, or four units on the opponent's space, then that's two coins that you could have gotten just by taking two empty spaces,
mm-hmm.
versus one coin from taking this space and the opponent's not getting one coin on their next turn, theoretically, and missing out on a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of also adds to a lot of in the game. There's a huge opportunity cost in everything. When you go in decline, you're not going to be able to expand that turn. So, like, you won't get, you know, X amount of gold for the spaces you could have taken. Or when you attack your opponent's pieces, you don't get the amount of gold for what you could have taken from empty territories.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that adds more to just, like, sort of the core strategy is all just sort of investing your actions and turns.
Right. So you will be heavily rewarded if you can think ahead at least two turns,
mm-hmm.
for both yourself and your opponents, and make sure that you are acquiring more gold than they are.
Mm-hmm.
And also you will be rewarded by tracking what your opponent is earning on each of their turns to have a general sense of which of your opponents has the most money, just in case you need to sacrifice a turn of gaining points just so that you can stymie their growth,
mm-hmm.
or their production of coins from like in decline tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And I generally find it good to take care of in decline tokens sooner rather than later,
yeah.
for your opponents, because those are just an investment that continues to pay dividends. So mm-hmm. because each race is and special power is balanced, you know, with the number of points you get,
yeah.
from their abilities and the number of units that they give you. So, you know, if you can assume that any race special power combination is relatively equal, then that means that the person with the most in decline tokens wins,
mm-hmm.
because every race and power is going to be getting relatively the same amount of coins.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not always true. But if you just think about it simply like that, I think that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, it does reward you for tracking very closely, you know, the every player's income of points and how many turns ahead you can think.
Yeah.
But I think that there is a general rule of thumb in this game, the sort of like a threshold of like success, and that is 10 or more points.
Mm-hmm.
You can obviously tell that there's like a threshold of 10 points in a turn. If you can gain 10 points or more in a turn, then you are doing well.
Yeah.
And if you're gaining less than 10 points, then you're not doing well.
And I'm going to be honest, it tells this really easily because the coin tokens you get with the game, it comes in increments of like 1,
3,
5,
and
10. In 10, other than the highest, it has like a little ruby in the zero of the 10.
So, let's go ahead and get into the game design now.
Yeah.
Because the game telegraphs to you with its visual design that 10 is important.
Yeah.
Because 1, you know, is like copper,
mm-hmm.
and 3 is silver, and 5 is gold. So it's, you know, brown, mm-hmm. and then silver, and then yellow. And then the 10 is like gold, but it's got this purple gem in the zero of the 10. And it feels real good.
Yeah, when you feels get that, really special.
That beautiful looking piece in your turn, mm-hmm. or when you get more, when you get 10 plus some. So it's kind of telegraphing to you that like rule of thumb that like you want to aspire to try and get 10 or more points in your turn.
There is also a strategic advantage to that. So the game encourages players to hide the number of points they have, but you keep public the number of tokens you have.
Right.
This is done by flipping the tokens over, basically.
So, visual design, what they did is they made the back of each token, or each point token, look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in game design, they tell you to keep it hidden,
mm-hmm.
Which is really cool,
mm-hmm.
Because that that leads to this, like, this up in the air, not knowing who's in first, technically, mm-hmm. until the end of the game. Which rewards a player for keep paying attention to who's getting mm-hmm. the most points. But it also doesn't make it so that, because it's very easy in a war game like this to have three players gang up on one.
Yes.
Because you are just, you're taking territory from one another mm-hmm. or expanding into empty territory where it's safe to expand. And it's just as easy to just turn and crush an army like that. That's really good. I really like that part about this game, and it makes it way less punishing because you're very often, like, you know, discouraged from punishing someone or, mm-hmm. or attacking someone aggressively, because usually it's worth less points, as you said before, mm-hmm. with the way defenses work.
I like it because it cuts back on the amount of politics in the game. I personally am not good at games that have a social element to doing well, where I have to, like, convince players or talk players into helping me. It's like, I can't play Werewolf or whatever. But this doesn't have that, because you can't tell who's in first or who's in last or whatever. Mm-hmm. The most of it is just, don't attack me.
Another thing, I think that this game, as far as games with fantasy illustrations go, I think this game nails it.
Yeah.
Better than almost any other game in its genre or category or anything. It mm-hmm. looks really, really good. The pieces look good. They could have gone all out with, like, wooden pieces for the units, but then it would have, I'm sure it would have been crazy. Well,
there expensive. Is the expensive collector's edition that has wooden pieces and metal tokens.
In the base set, they just go with the cardboard chips. But then if they were wooden, you know, they wouldn't really have, like, a flip side for the Indecline. So I think they did everything exactly right. The race tokens are, for the most part, very diverse in appearance,
mm-hmm.
So that at a glance, even in their small square space, you mm-hmm. can tell what they are,
and they're very expressive.
The illustration is very colorful and interesting. Some fantasy illustrations are kind of homogenous, like mm-hmm. the orcs and the goblins all look the same.
Yeah,
and
they're really bleak, like, this or pale.
Yeah, there's a huge difference in color and proportion and style to each character illustration. Plus, they even went ahead and made little logos for each race.
Oh yeah,
which you can see on the square. They're featured prominently on the little square chits in the corner, and they're also on the race placards themselves. Mm-hmm. Speaking of these placards, the race and special power placards have little illustrations that attempt to illustrate what the special abilities of each of them are. With a little mm-hmm. graphic.
Some of them really work. Like,
humans work.
And the similar ones that are just, like, a region or an area that gives you a bonus.
Uh-huh. And they made little icons that describe to you that, you know, like, you can conquer a space with one less piece. Mm-hmm. Like, on the orc, they have a little... Or on the giant, sorry. They have a little icon that says when they're attacking from a hill, they take one less... Or from a mountain, they take one less piece to conquer the adjacent region.
-1.
I
also like, so most abilities and races and all that, they don't do anything in decline. Like, they don't have any powers.
Yeah, your race just does nothing when it's in decline.
The races that do something in decline, not only does the backside have the ability on it, the front side has a little broken pillar icon that shows that it does happen in decline.
Mm-hmm.
So the trolls, the dwarves, and especially the ghouls, you'll see that on those
mm-hmm.
little character chits.
I also like how the races and special powers fit together kind of like a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they've cut the edge that where they connect.
Yeah, it's really nice.
And they've also cut it so at like a weird angle and a weird, you know, irregular shape that you can't fit them together any other way but the right way.
Yeah, they can't go like a puzzle.
Yeah, they can't. One of them can't be flipped over or rotated mm-hmm. in a weird way. There's only one way they can go, which is, you know, that's just a quality of life thing with the mm-hmm. game more. I do like that when you flip the cards over, if they have an ability, then it'll be there. But for the most part, it's just like a gray mm-hmm. color, and the in decline pieces on the board are also gray. They sort of lose their color. But that said, each race has its own unique color attributed to them. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, the Amazons are, like, a light green. you can see that very prominently on the borders of the squared chits. Mm-hmm. And when you flip a race over, it has sort of like a hint of that. It, even though it's grayed out, it's like a little faded, hint of that color.
Which is very apt.
Yes.
I really like that there are a number of effects that appear on both a race and a power, such as pillaging in orcs. Both give you money when you conquer a region from somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's other ones like Fortified and Troll, or Bivouacking and Troll are very similar. To the point where I think it's nice that, like, there's some very basic slash powerful slash influential stuff that is just, like I said, shared by those types of things.
And that's kind of a thing that can help other players that, you know, if you see two abilities that kind of align with one another, or like you see hill humans and you see the place on the map that has a lot of hills and farmlands, it's like, well, yeah, that's probably a really great combination. Yeah. Or you see like fortified trolls and you're like, those guys are never going to die.
Yeah.
Or you see like Amazons, which is really good at attacking, and Berserk, which lets you roll a special die every time you attack somebody to add to the temporary amount of pieces you get. You know, that's really strong, aggressive combination there. So you know, there's some obvious combinations of what's good, the ghouls, and what did you have?
Stout
ghouls was a really strong combination.
Yeah, stout lets you go in decline at the end of a regular turn, and ghouls are the only race that can move and conquer in decline.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought that on the first turn, immediately moved, went into decline, and just ran with it.
But like always, that I think put a target on your back.
Yeah.
At least for me, I knew that you had just really hit the jackpot with that first.
Yeah, and then
first buy.
Everybody punched me.
Yeah, and then everybody punched you. I picked the trolls as my first race when we played, and they have extra defenses in decline, which is kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
I picked them over the ghouls. Just because I think the ghouls were much further in the stack, so it would have cost more. And also, you know, I understood that at the beginning of the game, it's important to go in decline quick. And, you know, you want to keep your in decline races around as long as you want, as long as you can. So having that extra defense in decline gives them a little more resiliency.
Yeah.
Which was nice.
So if you remember, there is a different number of powers and races.
Yeah, there's 14 races and 20 powers.
And that actually works really well. I'll admit, at first, I was kind of put off by it. But the fact that you actually can cycle through all the races in one game pretty easily, especially with four or more players, and the fact that like there's an uneven number, like literally an uneven number, means that you will end up with different combinations of the same race in a different power.
In a game.
In a single game.
Right.
So you can't just get the same one again.
Right. And I like how randomness really makes the game emphasize your ability to think on the fly. Not only are your opponents expanding in places that are that could be difficult to predict, you know, making weird attacks that you hadn't planned for, so you need to plan your turns, you know, as they come to you, where what you're going to do. Not only that, but you know, the races could be anything moving forward. So you know, after everyone's picked their own race, there's four new races or however many new races per player available to pick from, and that's a lot, because that's a ton of new races and a ton of new opportunities. So being able to see the new races as they come and help that have that inform, you know, where you continue to expand and when you go in decline, so that you have the first pick of those new races too, is important in this game, and it's rewarding for players.
You know, it's really the only randomness in the game that makes a huge difference. There is the die that lets you try to take one last territory at the end of your turn.
Yeah, and we should mention what that die is.
Yeah.
It's a custom die for the game. It has three blank faces. It has a face with one square, a face with two squares, and a face with three squares. And you're allowed to roll it on your very last expansion of the game, or of the turn.
Yeah.
The very last expansion of the turn to conquer a territory. And it lets you attempt to conquer a territory that you don't have enough pieces to conquer by temporarily modifying the number of pieces you have to conquer it with. So if you roll a one, then you have one bonus piece that you're conquering with. And if you have two and three, you know.
But usually that makes a difference of like one or two coins altogether, one or two points. So that's why I would say like the races and powers unveiling is like I said, like the main randomness in the game. And I think that's what makes it from by being like a game that's going through the motions with some player interaction to just a game that actually has a lot of like thinking and decision making.
Mm-hmm. Now, something that's not random that's really nice is the board.
Yeah.
Which there are four boards that come with the game. You use a different board depending on how many players are playing. I think this is really crucial because the feel of the game is that after like turn three, it gets real cramped in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's going to be, you know, every player will probably have an incline race by about turn three or four. And every player will also have a new active race. So with, you know, two armies per player on the board, they needed to make sure the designers of this game needed to make sure that the people are interacting with each other the amount that the designers wanted them to interact. So they designed a custom board for the number of players playing so that, you know, at that point it starts to get cramped and your options become limited to where to go that's open.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of like a balancing factor for the beginning of the game with these ancient tribes that are like neutral characters that are on the board that you mm-hmm. can conquer and remove from the board for the whole game. And they sort of help to also simulate that the board is a little bit crowded,
mm-hmm.
Which I guess that's kind of like a ramp into the more crowded version of the
yeah.
board. But even still, like, you know, when they get to that third or fourth turn, it's going to be very crowded.
Yeah.
And I like that in the game mm-hmm. because it makes the decision of when to attack other people and when to just go in a different direction.
When to defend.
And where to defend. Yeah, it makes these decisions much more important and mm-hmm. come up much more often.
Intense.
Yeah. And it also, each board has, you know, it's not an even spread of all the different kinds of territories. You can tell that there's sort of clumped in certain places more than others. There's also like mines and places of magical power that are placed around the board. And those are also not spread just mm-hmm. evenly. It's always clumped and semi-random in a way like that, the way that they design the board. And there's also choke points because the territories are irregular. They're not like hexagons that all one territory is always touching six other territories. Instead, they're more like they're these weird blobby shapes that, you know, one territory could be touching just two others mm-hmm. or it could be touching seven others.
They look like actual land borders mm-hmm. in real life.
Oh, and the visual design of the game, you can definitely tell at a glance which territories are mountains, mm-hmm. which ones are swamps and fields. It's and
similar
farmlands.
Sort of color distinction in a lot of games.
Yeah. And there's also oceans and lakes mm-hmm. that serve as natural barriers, because as long as you're not a seafaring race, seafaring being one of the special powers, then you can't go onto the oceans or anything. So you're just stuck to the land masses.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to bring up at least one last thing.
Yep.
Which is, so with all the powers and races, there can be some really silly combinations, like flying elves or like underworld wizards, just stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's really fun that like the game sort of furthers this emergent gameplay stories. How like it's a game that just facilitates fun interactions and concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can have dragon master halflings or seafaring ratmen. And I mean, those ideas are already funny, but then, like, what happens in the game can also lead to stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mentioned the flying elves. One of the earlier times that we played this game, a friend of ours got flying elves, and elves can...
They're immortal?
They run away.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to think they're immortal.
I thought it was run away.
Because elves live forever. Yeah. When an elf territory is conquered, instead of losing one of your pieces and it going back to the tray, you keep all of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can never kill elves. They're always living.
And flying lets you attack anywhere instead of just adjacent territories.
Yeah.
So the guy who had flying elves went and decided to just destroy everybody's territories with a flying elf tower.
I mean, honestly, it was a bad strategy mm-hmm. because he never got more than, you know,
five points
because he could only conquer so many
and
territories.
And he never wanted to go in decline.
Yeah, and he never, yeah, honestly, yeah, he was playing the game for a different reason.
But it was fun. It was funny.
Yeah, it was fun and funny. He wasn't playing to win. He was playing to do this really weird, goofy thing mm-hmm. because he got a really weird, goofy race combination.
But I think it's cool that the game sort of encourages that in a way. I mean, the art definitely helps.
Yeah, the art's goofy.
Add to that fun sort of style, but I just think it's fun that you can have really wacky stuff happen in the game
mm-hmm.
that just, like you said, adds to just sort of the fun and silly and fantastical flavor of it.
Mm-hmm. All in all, this game is a really, really fun version of Risk. Like, you know, you hear a lot of negative things about Risk, how the games take forever, and, you know, you forge alliances and you destroy them.
Yeah.
And this game just throws that all out, and it's got a 9-turn limit. So it can only last so many turns, or a 10-turn. It's different for the number of players, it's different for the number of players. Small World is fun. It's lighthearted. It's not so crushing when somebody conquers you because you keep some of your pieces, and you can always go into Klein and start anew and wreck them with a brand new army, a fresh new army. You could even, if a person decimated your army and you go into Klein, you can specifically look for a new army that's going to counter their race and conquer it like crazy. You'll pick up like a giant and you notice that all their armies are surrounding this one mountain, so you take that mountain and then you just wipe them out. Which is something you can do, but that's not—it's not crazy detrimental to other players, you know. There's this balance that's going on, and for the most part, it's just fun.
It does have a lot, like we said, of replay value. I keep thinking to myself, like, oh, it would be cool if in a game this combination came up.
Yeah,
you know, it makes me want to try to keep playing so I can try to see what combinations.
It's also one of the only games I can think of where it also kind of encourages you to play with different numbers of players because there's all these different maps. You know, it's kind of like in a real time strategy game where you try out different maps to have different strategies. So it'll be fun to play with different numbers of players and see, like, let's check, see what the 3-player map is like, or let's see what the 5-player map is like.
Yeah.
As
similar games go?
Yeah, normally we talk about similar games here, and, you know, we keep talking about Risk. You don't have to play it.
You can play Risk Legacy, though.
Yeah, you've played some Risk Legacy.
A much more fun version, a much quicker version. Of course, it is a legacy game, and I think it's the first legacy game that released.
So it's quicker, as in a play session is quick.
But however,
you have to replay the game over and over, because in a legacy game, every time you play a game, you fundamentally change something about the game so that the next playthrough is very different.
Mm-hmm. In Risk Legacy, you add and name cities on the board, you blow up areas on the board and leave permanent land scars. Different things get added to the game when certain players win enough times or lose enough times. It's fun.
Yeah, so you can look for other, you know, area control games and war games.
As far as another light area control game, I'd have to go with Tigris and Euphrates. We mentioned it before on the Carcassonne episode, but it's a similar style of getting area and then getting points rewarded for your area.
Yep, there's a set board, and you have your army, and you place little square chits on the board to expand your territory and meet up against other players and then wage war with them.
In Tigris and Euphrates, though, your territory, when it gets taken from you, is like all your territory gets taken from you at once.
Yeah.
And it is also interesting because in that one you can share territory with people. And the game ramps up in scale really interestingly.
And you can also start from different points, right? Like, you can start a territory here and start a territory there and have them meet up later on if you want. Rather than, which is the opposite of Small World, which you start at one place and you expand outwards. Rather than in Tigris and Euphrates, you start in multiple places and expand together. But I would like to talk in similar games to just talk about one of the expansions for Small World.
Oh, yeah.
Because the Small World has a number of expansions. Some of them are standalone games that have all new boards. They always have expansions, always have new races and special abilities. There are small ones where you just get a handful of races and special abilities. But Small World Underground is like the Underdark version of Small World. It has 14 new races, 20 new special abilities. It's a standalone game. It's got its own board, but it changes up a lot of things. Like, all the races and special abilities are all very different. Instead of having oceans and lakes as natural barriers on the board, they have rivers, which anyone can conquer, but you cannot hold that at the end of the game. At the end of your turn, you have to leave the river. Which, you know, makes for you know, a more sprawling map with more fronts for fighting people. But it also has like pits and craters that you can't crawl into. And the new races and the special abilities, I find them more interesting than the ones in this game.
Some of them are just variations.
Yeah, some of them are variations. They obviously still have the ones that are like, you know, there's the bonus points for mushroom forests, mm-hmm. which is much like the humans, which get bonus points for farms, because mushroom forests are in the underground and not farms.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's other new interesting things. There's like a flame people that are strong if they're all connected in a line. Mm-hmm. There's spider people that can tunnel through the pits. And there's tons of other races.
Yeah.
The coolest thing about Underground is instead of having just the random neutral tribes on the map at the beginning of the game, they have these monsters on the map. They're stronger than the tribes because instead of just having one, they have two tokens at every point where they're placed at the beginning of the game. And when you defeat them, then you obtain either a random item or a random place of power appears in the place that you defeated them.
Mm-hmm.
So this really changes the dynamic of a game over time. Rather than it only being about managing what your opponents have collected and amassed for themselves and how much you need to inhibit their economic growth while also expanding your own in order to maximize the most points compared to your opponents. Instead, because these places of power and these artifacts pop up, then the game becomes more of like a contest for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still trying to get the most points, but the artifacts and places of power are very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sort of like becomes more of like a MOBA or something where you're sort of vying for
objectives.
Yeah, you're taking there's these objectives now on the board that you're sort of vying over. Mm-hmm. There's like a hill, like a King of the Hill type game, mm-hmm. where you're trying to maintain this one specific territory because it gives you a very powerful effect.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that added dynamic to this game.
Yeah, and it also adds a cool element of encouraging different openers.
Mm-hmm.
Like you might have a race combination that is good for expanding quickly, and then another one that is good for taking out a couple of monsters in the first couple turns,
right,
to quickly get those powerful stuff.
Right, there's a greater influence on obtaining these things first, mm-hmm. and gaining control of them first.
It allows for different play styles better.
Yeah.
But so, either way.
Yep. So thank you for listening to our episode on Small World.
Yep.
Once again, that is Small World. I remember reading a comment that some people dislike when people don't mention the name of the game enough.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll try to do that.
Okay.
We hope you like this episode. We tried to keep the intro portion a little bit shorter so we can talk a little bit more about the game. Hopefully that didn't lead to too much confusion. Confusion. If you want to hear our random thoughts, get notifications when we
go live
with episodes, you can follow us on social media.
Mm-hmm.
We are on Twitter and Facebook at BG Bros Cast. You can also check our website. That's where you can listen to our podcast or, you know, check out our blog. We don't really post anything to that blog right now.
Do we have a blog?
Yeah, we have. Well, technically, the blog is where I post the websites or where I post the episodes.
Great.
So, yeah, but you can check our website. That's where we have all our episodes. That's bgbcast.com.
Yep.
If you want, you can check out our friend's website. Chris and Roger and their friend Jason run a podcast called Entertain the Geeky and Nerd mm-hmm. News, where they post many episodes a week, talking about geek culture, geek news, being a geek.
They have many articles on their website as well,
mm-hmm.
talking about mainly geek news and geek retrospectives.
Mm-hmm. And that's entertainthegeeky.com, where you can check that out.
Our podcast is also hosted there.
Indeed it is.
And the games that we sell and that we will be selling are hosted there.
Right. So
right now, you can find Merle's Truck Stop in Maine for only $1.
The perfect March game.
Yep. A one-page role-playing game.
And all the money we make from Merle's Truck Stop in Maine is going towards producing our next game, which we're very excited to tell you about.
Whenever we can.
We are always excited to tell you about it, and very, very soon, we hope.
Hopefully.
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 To share more information on that with you.
Yeah.
And please, if you have any comments about this episode or any of our other episodes, if you like the intro, if you didn't like the intro, if you want a more in-depth description of how to play the game, which makes things maybe a little less confusing to beginning, or maybe if you like the shortness because it lets us get to the meat of the episode a little quicker, please leave a comment anywhere you want.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to leave it on, you know, a podcast app, you can do that. If you want to leave a comment on our
social media pages,
if you want to leave it on our website, I think we have some like Facebook interactivity mm-hmm. built into there. You know, please leave a comment. We want to make the podcast as good as we can make it, and mm-hmm. we can only do that with your unique opinions.
Feedback is appreciated.
Yeah, thank you very much for listening.
Oh, I also want to give a shout out to the Midnight Tavern, I believe it's called. The Midnight Tavern, it is an RPG podcast that is starting soon with some friends of ours that are also usually on Entertain the Geeky.
Yeah, not Chris and Roger?
Not Chris and Roger.
Just some...
It's run by Joe.
Friends of the podcast.
Yeah, Joe is on a lot of their episodes.
And that's the Midnight Tavern?
The Midnight Tavern.
And that will also
be on... Their Twitter is @TavernMidnight.
Cool. And I'm sure that'll also be on the Entertain the Geeky website.
I would assume.
All right, cool. Right. Yeah, check out Midnight Tavern.
Yep.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody.
Yep, thank you for listening.